Well, good morning, students. We are ready to begin the spring term in Humanities 2. And just as we started the Middle Ages by looking at three key individuals that played a huge role in that drama, the king, the pope, and Muhammad, so we're also going to look at three key individuals that play a major role in modern times. We're going to call these the doctors of modernity. Not because they're medical doctors per se, but the old use of the word doctor is teacher, like in doctrine. So the doctors of modernity are Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, and Sigmund Freud. I imagine you probably know the name Darwin the most because of his teachings on evolution, based on his book On the Origin of Species in 1859, and then The Descent of Man, where he finally made the link between the apes and humans, published in 1871. You're probably not as familiar with Karl Marx, who is the father of socialism, you might say, but more properly communism, along with Friedrich Engels, at least the great popularizer of it in theoretical mind behind it in the 1800s. And then Sigmund Freud, who's the father of psychoanalysis, which is a form of psychiatric care. I'll explain those a little later. Okay, so here's our goal today. I want to introduce to you the men as well as their theories. And in our school, we see all the world as connected, and so people are not separate from their ideas. And as a result of that, we need to consider both together. And so as we start the modern era in Europe, looking in the spring term, we're going to begin by these lives and their ideas. Charles Darwin was born on February 12, 1809, the same day as Abraham Lincoln. He was a naturalist at heart. He collected all sorts of things, and wherever he went, he would go to the seaside and look for strange items and collect them. He loved nature. When he was sent to the University of Edinburgh to study medicine, he was bored. But he got in touch with a zoologist, Robert Grant, and they would go to the seaside and look for strange sea creatures. At the University of Edinburgh, or Cambridge, excuse me, he prepared for the ministry in the Church of England. But he was also bored with his theology classes and attended lectures by the botanist John Stevens Henslow, and got really good friends with geologist Adam Sedgwick. In fact, Darwin was a geologist before he was ever a zoologist. He really enjoyed the topic of the study of rocks and the formation of the Earth's crust. You might say, why did he go into the ministry? It was his dad's idea, and he liked it because his dad thought it would give him a great income. In the Church of England being paid by taxes, there's not really much of a failure rate there at that time. And he loved it because he wanted to go to the countryside where he could study nature and have a pension. Well, his major breakthrough came when he got invited to the HMS Beagle and a voyage around the world to do surveying, mainly around South America. He was to be the cabin companion of Captain Robert Fitzroy. And so basically, when you think about a five-year voyage on a small vessel, it's not very big, I can imagine that apart from the crew, if you were an aristocrat like Fitzroy, you would like to have somebody who you could talk intellectually with. And he actually replaced the previous captain who had committed suicide off the coast of Argentina. On that voyage, Darwin went on shore and collected all sorts of specimens, a variety of things. He read Charles Lyell's book on geology, and he studied the formation of the rocks. And he sent back his notes to England, where they were beginning to take, people in scientific circles were beginning to take note. When he got back and his collections then were examined by others in science, he became famous. This is the voyage, really, the experience that made Charles Darwin. It's on that ship that he then began to, it's from the collections that he made on that ship that evolution began to be firmly planted in his mind. Up until that point, he was not an evolutionist, though his grandpa, Erasmus Darwin, was a famous evolutionist. He actually became an evolutionist because of an insight that John Gould, an ornithologist, a study of birds, made about the Galapagos finches. These islands off the western coast of South America had finches that were never seen before. And as one writer I know I read said, the penny dropped at that point, and Darwin began to see the non-fixity of species. In other words, that the species you learned about in biology class change over time, rather than the way the Bible says that they were created after their kind in fixed categories that never change. And so, with that idea implanted in him, as well as some memories of some savages that he saw at the southernmost tip of South America, Tierra del Fuego, basically he said if you had any doubts about the animal ancestry of man, you could look on the faces of those savages that he saw there and it would erase those doubts. Something to that effect. That became a point of interest. Now, it's as a side note, the captain, Fitzroy, had actually taken captive some of those Fuegians and brought them to England in hopes to convert them to Christianity, at least in the long run, in the short run, to civilize them, teach them some of the arts and technology of England. And so Fitzroy, later on, I think was in contact with Darwin, and there was a missionary society, a missionary endeavor to those people that was successful. And Darwin then said, basically announced his error about those people and supported the mission endeavor, not because of Christ, but because of civilizing people and spreading British society around the world. But he still seemed to retain the idea that these primitive people are testimony to the ancestral past, the animal ancestry of man. And so Darwin then began to ponder. Having now gone on this 5-year voyage and having evolution in his mind, he began to ponder, how did that happen? And so notebooks were being filled with thoughts from conversations and readings and little insights that he received until 6 notebooks were secretly filled from 1837 to 1839. But it was finally when he read Thomas Malthus' book on the principles of population, basically that someday the world will be so filled with people that we can't feed them all, and the struggle of life, the struggle for survival, that the idea of natural selection occurred to him. Now just note, others had believed in evolution before Darwin. Lamarck, for example, believed that acquired traits through habits could be passed on to the next generation. That's Lamarckian evolution. Darwin is the one that came up with natural selection. In other words, the trait that best enabled a species to survive in a changing environment was the one then that was passed on to offspring, because those species survived and the ability then to make them survive became passed along. And so this Darwinian idea is still the idea today that is behind modern evolution. The sketch of 1844 is a short book he put together thinking he was going to die. We speculate about why his health became poor at that point, but he basically wrote up his ideas and committed it to the care of a young naturalist named Joseph Hooker, that if he should die, he should publish it. Now, at this time, he didn't want it published, partly because he had memories of an infidel, a bad priest, coming to the campus at the University of Cambridge and being ridden off campus and ridden out of town as the devil's chaplain because he tried to take people away from Christianity. He knew that the Society of England was still still strongly against any of these atheistic ideas or an idea of such, really it's more naturalistic explanation for the origin of life, believing in a miraculous creation, that he would lose his social status. He would risk it. And so if he were dead, sure, publish it, but not yet. And he confided in Joseph Hooker that it feels like confessing a murder. In other words, it feels like I'm killing off God. It's that feeling underneath that made Darwin uneasy to some degree, not because he didn't believe it. And he couldn't square it up with all his evidence. He ended up dying as an agnostic because he could never square the chance of evolution, even though he thought of natural selection as a law, yet with a first cause and how everything could come about. So he's kind of deistic in that way, but at least an agnostic, I don't know. Not a staunch atheist in that sense. The other thing that it made him hesitate to publish is that he wanted to improve his status as a zoologist. And so he studied barnacles for 8 years, from 1846 to 54. Now, barnacles are the little guys that stick to the hulls of ships. He sent out tons of letters, and many people helped him, and he collected 10,000 specimens of barnacles. And it's a credit to his zoological abilities that he could catalog them and keep track of all that data. Genuinely, he is a scientist, and his zoology abilities as a naturalist are really strong. He did many studies through his life. Once that was established, he did finally publish his views on evolution. And it was, in the words of some who have commented on it, I've not read it. I hope to read it someday. But it was, in the words of those who commented on it, like a reformer's book. It was a long argument, passionately, basically arguing against a miraculous creation, but then speaking not of evolution, but of a creation by natural law. The law of natural selection. Later used evolution in his book, The Descent of Man. At the end of his life, he's buried in Westminster Abbey as if he was a Christian. And somebody even claimed that they converted him. Lady Hope is her name. And it was spread around America 100 years ago. But that's there is such little evidence for that, so I would not encourage you to believe that he renounced his views at the end of his life. His last study was on earthworms. Whether he was thinking about dying soon or not, some have speculated, but that was his last study. So what happened to this man that was preparing for the ministry? Well, every man, even an atheist, has a theology, a concept of God. Even if it's a concept of a God you deny exists. For you must have some idea of what you're denying exists. So Darwin had a theology in mind, even as he's writing against a miraculous creation. What is Darwin's theology? Well, his dad was an atheistic, or at least an agnostic, son of Erasmus Darwin, the botanist, doctor, and evolutionist. So there's not much religion on that side. But his mom's family, the Wedgwood family, was very religious. They were Unitarians. They denied the Trinity. They were rationalistic in that sense. But they went to the Church of England because it was socially acceptable and esteemed to be a part of that Christian church in England. And they were potters. One of their famous pieces of pottery was an abolitionist piece, an anti-slavery piece, that had a man in chains, "Am I not a man?" and a brother written on it. So they were very much into social causes as well as religious. And Darwin, to the end of his day, remained a supporter of social causes and for the social good. But he did not remain religious his whole life. He started life, like his mother, with a Unitarian religion that used the Bible as a moral guide. And he even on the Beagle would talk about it with other sailors and was not ashamed to support the morality of the Bible and to use it. But as I said, he ended his life as an agnostic, kind of a deist in sorts. So what happened to his theology? Well, what happened appears to be that tragedy struck. He lost his dad in 1848, but even worse, in 1851, he lost his 10-year-old daughter, Annie. And his sensibilities could not handle these deaths. In fact, he was so distraught over these, he couldn't even attend the funeral of either. And so the God that Darwin had in his mind was the God of what they call natural theology. The God that reason thinks up. The God that does everything perfectly. But it's perfect in the way that humans assume it's perfect. Whether in the natural order in creation, the watchmaker of William Paley, or in the moral order, the God of the three friends of Job, who always does what is right and rewards the righteous and punishes the wicked kind of thing. Not saying that those in natural theology were that simplistic, but it's still a rationalistic God. It's a God that we think exists and would do things in this way and this way perfectly. As with Job, that view of God does not hold up to the harsh realities of life. It's a fragile picture of God. Nor does it match the kind of world that we see in the animals, red and tooth and claw, that world that is savage. Is that a world that's perfect? No, there's a lot of flaws and pathologies and diseases and brokenness. What kind of a world is that? Well, that world is a world that testifies to the design of God, like John Calvin said, to a ruined temple. We can see the good design that should be there, but we also see the destructive forces of disease, the brokenness of it. So the God of the Bible is strongly testified by and matches with the world that we see, both humans and nature. But the God of Darwin and of his mother's family could not stand up to the harsh realities of his life, nor to the facts in that way of the natural order. And so Darwin lost his faith, and his book, as an article that I signed at the college for readings that I do, the book that speaks about a Darwin straw God argument by Jonathan Wells, that Darwin is fighting against that image of God in his book On the Origin of Species. Well, let's go on to the next figure then, Karl Marx, also in the 19th century, born in 1818. He is a genius. No questions. From what I read by Mark Skousen on this, he's a genius. He had a genuine doctorate in Greek philosophy. He spoke fluently in German and French and English, read voraciously on all sorts of things. Yet one of those absent-minded kind of professor guys, he never could keep a job, couldn't balance a checkbook, that kind of a thing. But even more than that, he's a visionary and a revolutionary idol. Even today, Marxist thought and Marxism speaks of revolution, of basically destroying everything and building it up from scratch again. His strong claims, which almost Skousen would say, like, make you say you should believe it even without evidence. His strong claims are very religious, and youthful followers often become true believers, as if they're addicted. The editor of World Magazine, or one of the main editors, Marvin Alasky, is a Jewish Christian. He used to be a communist. He testifies to the pull that this had in the 1960s on young men. Remember, one church history scholar, Michael Haken, was also into communism in his college days and had thoughts about killing his father, and yet would be so frightened. And so was very much plagued with all sorts of phobia. It's an interesting, and there's other more famous stories like Whitaker Chambers, who wrote the book Witness. And what broke the spell for him was a child. Were those in the party have the party line to think of and shouldn't even have a child. I mean, marriage basically is suppressed for the good of the communist agenda. And having that child awoke in him and his wife a sense of values outside of communism. And so all the symbols, the sayings, the color red, you know, the sickle and the hammer, speaking of the workers of the world in the factories and in the field, the martyrs, the Bible, not the Bible, the Holy Bible, but their Bible, written by Marx, all that speaks of its religious nature. Now, what do we think about this man, Marx himself? He's deeply contradicting. I appreciated what Marx Goossen pointed out in that he deeply felt for the working man, yet never had a job, a steady job himself, nor visited a factory as an adult. He deeply cherished his children, yet they were malnourished and ill. And the only two that survived of his six out of childhood, two daughters later committed suicide, one upon learning that his dad had an illegitimate child. In fact, Marx himself was fascinated by the topic of suicide. And so like a man in church history I read, J.N. Darby, on the one hand could be humble, it appeared, caring, and yet on the other hand could be so egotistical. I think that's due to the fact that we can be humble in service, but if we don't deny ourselves before taking up the cross becomes another way of affirming our own name and our own pride. Jesus said you have to deny yourself and then take up your cross. Well, he also was deeply anti-Semitic. And you say, well, so are a lot of people. They hate the Jews. But the weird thing is, he's Jewish. On both sides of his family, he descended from rabbis. And it wasn't just hating them as a religion, being against them like Luther was. It was truly a racist thing. He even talked about the shape of their brain and their skull with a science then called phrenology. And you could tell a person's character by the bumps on their heads. And even more, even though he was a communist, later he lived his life in London like a bourgeois gentleman. That's a saying for middle class. And he even speculated on the stock market. That's the first thing to go, apparently, when communists take over a country. And so he acted like somebody that was not a communist, or not a Jew, or not a family man, or not a working man. And so what do we think about this guy? Well, his family quit their Judaism, Jewishness, in order to adopt Christianity. And in his early days, he was Christian, at least in high school. But when he went to college, he became wild and partying. He would read a lot, but he wouldn't stick with his studies much. One man wrote a poem about him who rushes in impetuous and wild. I guess he was very, very strongly opinionated and would have piercing eyes. He could go 3 to 4 days reading a book without sleeping. And so in college, he began to adopt some of the philosophy of the day, of Hegel, and you don't need to know this. You will learn a little bit from Francis Schaeffer, but Hegel combines conflict, two things that are contradictory, and says progress comes through conflict. It kind of reminds me of Darwin, how progress, you might say, in the animal species comes through death, the survival of the fittest, which is a phrase Darwin didn't coin, but somebody else did. He also bought into the philosophy of a man named Feuerbach that said God didn't create man, but man created God. Karl Marx is very famous for saying that religion is the opium of the people, like a crutch that kind of numbs them and gets them by. Well, he met this man, Friedrich Engels, and together they wrote the Communist Manifesto, which is a book that we read in public policy in our senior class. This man also was a man that hated his father, who he viewed as tyrannical. He was conflicting as well because he encouraged Marx to look into economics and develop his theory of how people how basically money and things is what creates society, and it determines people. They're not free beings. It's materialistic, and their things determine their future. And yet he had a factory. So while he denounced the capitalists, he himself was a capitalist having a factory. Now, a capitalist is somebody that basically gets capital, which is savings, sets it aside and builds up enough in order to buy better tools. Or other people save their money and invest it in a company called the stock market. So that system where there's private ownership and personal desire to profit was what Karl Marx fought against in his view that everybody should hold everything in common. Which would work great if people were angels, but that doesn't work well when you deal with just common man. And so everywhere communism has spread in the world, it has led to all sorts of violations of what they call human rights. We would call them transgressions against God in mistreating those made in his image. Well, the famous book that Karl Marx wrote is called Das Kapital in 1861. Apparently, I've seen a copy of it, I believe, in a library. It was translated into English and then eventually even into French and Russian, where it became the basis of Vladimir Lenin's takeover of Russia and the communist takeover of Russia in the Bolshevik Revolution. I understand it's just a very confusing book, but that's part of the appeal, apparently. The allure. It's tough. It's difficult. And you get that feel with communism, like, this is for real men. Instead of the invisible hand of Adam Smith and how the market's going to work itself out through self-interest, you have the iron fist of communism and forcing its way into revolution, leveling everything and making everybody equal by force. Well, we're going to talk about his theory later in economics, but basically his main assumption was that price should be determined by the amount of labor put into something. So if you've ever drawn a picture and you wanted to sell it, you know how ugly this gets. I put 10 hours into drawing this, and you only want to give me 10 bucks? That's like $1 per hour wage. This should be worth at least $200. Well, you know, it's going to be worth what the buyer thinks it's worth, right? And so the theory doesn't hold up well. If wine becomes more expensive the longer it sits in the cellar, there's no labor being added to it, but the price keeps going up. Or as one man said, men don't dive for pearls. I mean, the price of pearls isn't expensive because men dive for it. Men dive for pearls because pearls are valuable. There's a lot of ways to describe it, but basically his claim was that the workers in the fields and the factories, there's what puts the value into the product. And so when these factory owners haul off with a bunch of money, they're stealing from their workers. And communism then creates a class conflict between the poor and the rich, or the laboring class, and then the owners. Okay, that's man number two. Finally, man number three, Sigmund Freud. Sigmund Freud is an Austrian Jew who studied medicine, actually the brain, then hysteria and even hypnotics on trying to cure people with brain problems or neurotic or psychotic problems. He even toyed with cocaine as a possible way for anesthesia in the late 1800s, and he used it himself for a while. His breakthrough was The Interpretation of Dreams, published in 1900. It starts the psychoanalytic school, or psychoanalysis, which is a revolution in psychology. You know what it is. People feel guilty. And so their conscience, which he called the superego, is conflicting with their basic urges of aggression or violence or sexual desire. Their conscience is saying no, and their id, he called it, their deep down subconscious desires are saying yes. And so the therapist, the psychiatric caregiver, then brings all this conflict to the level of consciousness in the ego so that it can get resolved. Now, the way Freud wanted to resolve the conflict, all of us know this. Somebody takes your toy when you're a kid, you want to hit them. I want to get it back. And then there's all sorts of temptations like that, we call them. And our conscience, given by God, to be a voice of God in our lives, says no. Well, Freud's way of dealing with it was, we need to destroy the conscience. We need to quiet the superego and just say, and let the id, the urges, do what they want. It would be unfair to hold somebody to fight their urges. That's impossible. Now, we know it's impossible because it's impossible for fallen man to keep the law. But we know that what with man is impossible, with God is possible. And salvation can make a man do it. Well, Freud denied it. And his cure was to basically to cure guilt feelings by getting rid of real guilt. You didn't actually break the law. Now you can see how subversive this is to religion. Well, there's all sorts of other theories that he attached to it. Theories like, you know, the conscience came about because way in the past, a group of primitive people killed the father. And then that kind of guilt was upon them. And it got brought and passed along to their offsprings. And so the conscience is like, and even God is the projection of a father figure. It's not really there. Freud was an atheist. And so we need to get rid of that. Another thing that he talked about is that there are suppressed memories in people and that the guilt feelings are due to things in their distant past that they can't remember. And dreams, wish fulfillments, in disguised forms are the means that the therapist then can get down to those earlier experiences. And oftentimes, because they're self-deceived, they need help in interpreting their dreams. And so you got to go to the expert. Now, psychiatric care, 70, 80 years ago in America, was very expensive and involved hours, repeated journeys to the couch. They called them the shrink in those days. Well, in this, we have a denial of what's called the moral model for the medical model. Somebody isn't a sinner committing sin, they're just sick. And they need healing. Can you see why this is a doctor of modernity? It's not just that evolution is on the scene. It's not just that communism is out there or that economics is going to be the cure to our society's problems. It's also that in psychology, we have erased the idea of responsibility and everybody gets to be a victim. And if you feel guilty, it's somebody else's problem, often your parents or your distant past. And it's not to say that there isn't a problem sometimes. Sometimes parents are the problem for a good bit of hurt and such. But our own choices add to the problem. And we are responsible not for their actions, but for how we react to their actions, how we internalize it and deal with it. So this lack of responsibility created a crisis in the psychiatric world in the 1950s. A man named Hobart Maurer, J. Adams, the biblical counselor, the father of nouthetic counseling, he's a Christian, started a whole movement for pastors to kind of take up the psychiatric care of people in their churches and don't just refer them to Freudian psychologists who will deny them having responsibility. Talk about sin. Rather than have them confess to a psychiatrist, confess to God. So help them in that. Well, Adams talks about this guy Maurer who then started asserting responsibility for actions. Seems like this must come in a wave. Recently, I remember reading a World Magazine talk about Jordan Peterson and Ben Shapiro and Dennis Prager asserting that young men should be responsible for their actions. And it really does start the cure, really. Hopefully they begin to find out I am responsible and also unable, and they look to Jesus for the blood to cleanse them and for the Holy Spirit to empower them. Well, eventually psychiatry became basically a pill-giving service. The difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist is that a psychologist is mainly a test, administers tests and often counseling. A psychiatrist administers prescriptive drugs and does some counseling. And so they have a medical background. And so now we see, you know, anti-anxiety drugs and depression pills and things like that. Those are things we'll talk about in public policy again. Right now, I just want you to see that Freud is a major player in the modern world. Well, in the 1920s, C.S. Lewis had some problems with Freud because he was planting doubts in his mind. Lewis had these yearnings for a joy outside of himself, and Freud came along and said, it's just a wish. It's your desires. It's wish fulfillment, is what he called it. Well, the resolution for Lewis was to notice that modern thought is self-refuting. Well, your claim then must be due to desire in you. And if it's not, well, then you need to treat my thought as having some validity and answer it on its own ground. And you just can't claim that all ideas are just wish fulfillment. It's that idea self-refuting that a recent book by E. Michael Jones called Degenerate Moderns, and I wouldn't recommend it per se. He has some parts that I don't think are trustworthy. But it's interesting that, as Mark Coppinger, a teacher down at Southern Seminary, said, he got the idea from Jones that in contrast to Richard Weaver saying ideas have consequences, Jones basically said consequences have ideas. That there are some times when people want to do something that they then create a theory that justifies it. Kind of like you and I, when we want to do something, go somewhere, we come up with reasons. We rationalize it. Or when we don't want to feel guilty, we come up with excuses. And basically Jones is saying that Freud's whole theory is due to that. Freud claimed that a lot of the background of ideas and people's problems come to their difficulties over feeling guilty about sexual experience. And so he tried to get rid of that guilt. But when you go into the letters of Freud and his own personal thoughts and his family life, you find all sorts of tragic occurrences. It appears like he was molested as a child and suffered from it. But rather than deal with the sin of his father and going to God and seeking to find healing in some sense in that way, and then keeping his father to blame, he ended up reversing it and grabbing an abomination himself and committing a horrible act, hard to even mention it. And in doing so, he quoted Nietzsche, who was a godless philosopher who went insane, and he actually may be the doctor of modernity behind Freud. Freud said later that his theories had amazing similarities and agreement with Nietzsche's thought. It seems like Freud actually borrowed from Nietzsche without giving him credit. But Nietzsche talked about destroying the conscience, fighting against nature and asserting our will over nature by doing something horrific. Do you remember the Peace Child book from a freshman year? How the Sawi people were described by Don Richardson as doing gefam asan, touching the stench. They would reach into a dead body and then eat with it to try and force nature in a wanus bind, they call it, to give up her secrets about the coming Ramon or regeneration of all life. It's that kind of fighting against nature, fighting against conscience and doing something horrific to assert your will and to say, I will not feel guilty. I'm going to do this. Well, talk about not submitting to God. Talk about, as the Bible would say, destroying a person. This destroys a person. And for the rest of his life, Freud kept affirming over and over again the goodness of and the legitimacy of committing this horrific crime. I remember when I was first preparing for the syllabus at Spring Branch Academy, I was reading a Greek play by Sophocles called Oedipus Rex. And in that play, Oedipus, the king, ends up killing his father without knowing it. He's the king of another realm, and then taking his wife and sleeping with her. He's sleeping with his mother. When I realized that, I was engrossed in the story because it was a very beautifully written story. When I realized it, I spit, literally. I mean, it's like my whole inside puked, like, ugh, this is horrible. This is abominable, which is Hebrew for disgusting. I can't have students read this. That's what Freud actually claimed is the basis behind the psyche. He called it an Oedipus complex, the desire to kill the father and sleep with the mother, or sleep with the mother and kill the rival, the father. It's sick. The whole thing is sick. And he made some outlandish claims by the end of his life to back this up, claims that anthropologists flat out denied. That's not the history of cultures in the world. So, what do we do with these three men? Darwin, Marx, and Freud. All of them very independent. Darwin, secretive. Marx, critical. Freud, very, very personally affronted when somebody would disagree with him. They had big egos in that sense about their ideas. In fact, Marx and Freud developed their own vocabulary. To be versed in communist thought or psychotherapy, you have to learn a whole new set of terms. And that those who talk it, talk among themselves, and we can't even understand it. It feels very scientific. I think it ends up isolating them, which they probably like because it keeps their followers devoted. Remember how language in the fall we said defines nations? Well, it defines these groups too. All three of them were materialistic. There's no God. There's no supernatural power at work in any of their theories. Whether it's natural selection in Darwin, or it's economic determinism in Marx, people are what their money situation and social class status is, or whether it's the unconscious in Freud. They were all anti-religious, and yet deeply religious. It's interesting, Marx grew his beard and his hair out to match a bust of Zeus that he had given to him. It was his favorite possession, and he wanted to look like Zeus. That look is on the top of his tomb in London. Freud, he claimed that religion is the projection of a father figure, and then he made claims that Moses was an Egyptian, and that the Egyptians committed incest, and in doing so asserted that they were a god. And that's the abomination that he committed. And in doing so, he called it divine, which is blasphemous and sacrilegious. Defining one's own reality. I get to say what is right and what is wrong. I get to be God, is the lie that our mother Eve fell for in the garden. Eat from it and you will be like God. It's as if I get to be what God's name is. I am. I will be what I will be. This is the freedom that the radicals in the 1960s grabbed for themselves in the hippie generation when they were fighting for the rights of the blacks in the South. It's the same definition of liberty that the postmodernists give, which is now backed up by the Supreme Court. And I say this, it was like, wow, is Freud one of the fathers of our modern immorality? I have to say yes. For all that generation that was on the couch in the early 20th century, they couldn't be openly adulterous and have affairs in our cities because our culture, due to its Christian heritage, frowned upon it. So they felt guilty about it. And then they go to the Freudian psychiatrist who would then say it's not really wrong and try to assuage their guilt feelings and get them away, because guilt feelings really are harmful. But we don't confess it to a psychiatrist. We confess it to Jesus, and his blood cleanses us. We don't have to close our eyes to what is right and wrong, true and false. We can affirm reality and affirm his law because Jesus, perfect God and perfect man, died in our place. But all that generation then did not acknowledge their guilt and lived a hypocritical life on Sunday in church and then during the week sinning and trying to get rid of the very guilt that their Sunday morning service should have told them was wrong. No wonder then the hippie generation didn't esteem that authority as being valid and saw hypocrisy in it as a cultural thing. It's that generation that then takes the place of the leaders in our society today. And so the Supreme Court, in backing up abortion in 1992 and homosexuality in 2003, made this claim about liberty. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. That's Freudian at its very core, not related to the world that God made. You know the ultimate source of this deep religion? I think it's of Satan. Not maybe explicitly like Carl Jung, who broke from Freud and established his own theory of psychoanalysis. He actually had a spirit guide and was heavily into the occult and affirmed the unconscious as part of the spirit world. That is the doctrines of demons, 1 Timothy 4:1. But I do think it's still demonic and diabolical or devilish. Freud and Marx were both atheistic, and even though they weren't into the occult, they were both fascinated with Faust. If you remember, Faust is the guy that made a pact with the devil. He's going to be powerful. He sells his soul for power and for knowledge. I don't know the story well, but that's what I understand it to be. And Goethe's Faust was Marx's Bible, Skusen said, throughout his life. He even told his fiancée, Jenny, if we could but weld our souls together, then with contempt shall I fling my glove in the world's face. Then shall I stride through the wreckage, a creator. Freud also quoted Goethe about Faust and asserted his own will and became what he quoted from Nietzsche, Superman. That kind of pride through just flouting God is what the devil himself did. And it's what the devil tried to tempt Jesus to do when he said, if you bow down to me, I'll give you everything. So Freud once claimed that only a Jew could develop psychoanalysis. Perhaps he's right. Not because all Jews are unbelievers. The Apostle Paul tells us there's a remnant. But when Jews go bad, like Marx and Freud, the genius that God had blessed them with goes diabolical. We see this in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, where Jesus himself calls a synagogue of Satan. They claim that they're Jews, but it's only a name. It's really Satan that controls their synagogue. And all this esoteric dream interpretation and so-called depth psychology reminds me of the deep things of Satan. The Gnostic separation of the body and soul in Carl Jung is something that we're told in 1 Timothy to stay clear of. And so, aren't you glad that Jesus Christ resisted the Faustian temptation to rule the world by bowing to Satan? He resisted it for you and for his God to die in your place so that you can fully admit in all truthfulness, I've done this wrong and this wrong and this wrong, and bring them all to Jesus and not only get those individual sins forgiven, but have yourself reckoned righteous in his sight through union with him by faith, where his status as the Son of God becomes your status, and his very spirit comes and indwells you long before you rise from the dead, long before you go to heaven. Heaven comes and lives in you, so that you then have the power to fight against what Freud said could never be done. But Christian after Christian prove him wrong. Addicts are freed. And if the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. And we then, with all confidence, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience, sprinkled clean from an evil conscience, are bold to approach God in the full assurance of faith. That's what God has done for us. And so we don't need to destroy the world to create it. Jesus will remake the world. We don't need to deny guilt in order to be free. Jesus affirmed our guiltiness and then took our place and died in our place. And we don't need to think of ourselves as made in the image of an ape, but we can think of ourselves in truth as made in the image of God, created to know him, talk with him, and enjoy him forever. And so even though we have called this era of modern Europe ruin, beginning with Renaissance, Reformation, Rationalism, Revolution, and ruin, and yes, we see it in ruins around us, God may still bring a short revival to our culture, but he can bring revival to your heart and to mine. And so we praise him for that. And so you're going to read on the death of Ivan Illich, a book by Leo Tolstoy, a Russian novelist. It's called a novella, a short novel, and it's very interior because it's a dying man and he realizes how alone he is. I think the descriptions are accurate, but I question the ending or the conclusion. And so let's talk about that as a class when we meet. Thank you.